for data in one jurisdiction, you may be at risk of violating the law of another jurisdiction. So, and you know, from the point of view of individual customers, how do you know what legal regime your service provider is going to have to answer to? So that's why I think jurisdiction is a really important question for us to understand, and how if we don't get it right, we really risk having cloud computing not work well for either institutions or individuals or governments. So while I don't think that we can define a solution today, I'd like to throw out some principles that I think we ought to use to try to define a legal regimen around jurisdictional issues in cloud. The first principle, I think, is a principle of broad inclusion. And I think that what I mean by that is you really have to think through the needs of every participant group in the cloud ecosystem. And that's governments, it's businesses, it's service providers and business customers, it's individuals, it's institutions, it's any group that has a stake in how they are affected by cloud computing. Now these interests sometimes are going to overlap, in which case it's easy. Sometimes they won't, in which case there's got to be a balance. And so it's going to be really important to have everyone at the table talking about what the right balance is if we're going to have a sustainable legal framework around cloud computing. And as I say, I think jurisdiction is a fundamental part of what that sustainable framework has to take. And then the second principle, which is related to that, is really a principle of engagement. And I think this goes to things that Sloane has been talking about trust. When I say we need to find a solution, I really do mean we. It has to be everybody. Because if every stakeholder doesn't believe that they've been heard, their interests have been considered, you're not going to get the kind of trust and buy-in to a solution that's going to work. At the end of the day, stakeholders can accept a situation that isn't perfect from their point of view if they think it's fair and they can fairly arrive at. So I think the point of view of getting engagement and thoughtful leadership on these issues is really, really important. An example of that, I think, is the Global Network Initiative, which the Berkman Center has been so actively involved in. It was an initiative that involved very broad engagement among industry, privacy and human rights organizations, academics, and other stakeholders to talk about what principles should govern. And I think working with that kind of model on jurisdictional legal issues would be a really helpful thing to no one company or country or person can be able to solve this problem. It's going to require a commitment and engagement across the country. The third principle I suggest is one about innovation. Whatever legal framework we adopt and agree to has to be able to foster and support innovation and unleash the power and promise of cloud computing rather than restrict it. And I think by that, I mean we have to figure out a regimen that allows freedom of choice in technology and service, access, broad access to technology and service, and to enable businesses to act more competitively and more agile. So innovation would be preferred. And then the fourth principle is I think we really do need to define a role for government. Over-regulation may stifle innovation, but going back to a point that was made earlier about the internet, if you allow things to develop in a totally ad hoc, hands-off manner, then you create other problems or allow other problems to develop. So if you look at the internet, which was really developed without regard to regulation around security or privacy, there are problems about it. If you think about coming up with it starts with the premise that government should have some role and to define what that role is, then I think we're more likely to get some of these problems out of the box. And finally, and obviously most important, any solution to be more these problems, no country can be able to impose its sense of what the right jurisdiction or the right answer to any substantive issues are. So I guess my conclusion is we've got some principles, we've got some problems, and what we need is really engaged leadership to solve them. And I would throw out a challenge to the Berkman Center that you are very well positioned to get the right group of people at the table to start.
Thank you very much. So as you pointed out, Andrei, we have a set of problems presented by Herford. We have a number of guiding principles, as you proposed them. And now I think the question to Cliff actually is, what's the right priority? What are like the most pressing concerns from your viewpoint? What are the main issues that we should address first? Referring probably to some of the processes suggested by Anne-Marie.
Thanks. Well, I had some of my own thoughts on this, but I also thought it would be helpful to talk to some of my former colleagues in the in-house community of different businesses and try to do a very informal survey or focus group of what their view is of cloud computing, whether it's on their radar, and if so, whether they're adopting it, and if not, what are the obstacles to adoption. And in those conversations, what I learned was that, first of all, it is very much on their radar, and for reasons of cost, efficiency, functionality, and other advantages. But that there is considerable reluctance to embrace it. And the obstacles that people raised really fall into four categories: security, reliability, privacy, and data ownership. And that these were very real and concrete problems that they had encountered in exploring the options in negotiation. In a general sense, those four concepts are kind of self-evident, and they've been talked about, and we can talk about them more. But I think they are kind of big and important issues and practical obstacles right now. One thing I thought that was interesting about the first two, security and reliability, is that often those two, in fact, are touted as advantages of cloud computing because each entity doesn't have to do that on its own. And what I was told was that in talking about commercial arrangements for cloud computing, there are very explicit disclaimers on security and reliability. And with some companies, it's possible to get guarantees of security and reliability, but at very hefty premiums if you out there guarantee, which then takes away some of the advantages of cost. So, so those are the four kind of big obstacles that came up. And in dealing with them, of course, we've got the choice of private responses, governmental responses, and some combination of the two. I think one of the most important things that we can do today and in this process is try to chart which are most appropriate for which avenue. And in the private area, we think about what happened with privacy, with institutions like trustee, with the growth of things like privacy policies. Were those adequate? Is that the way to go on some of these things, that some sort of goading and examples to develop private norms? Is there a possibility for competitive differentiation on that basis? What are the things that are susceptible to the enactment of laws or the adoption of regulations, whether it's a Vermont law, whether there should be a push for certain kinds of uniform code so that there aren't differences among states or among countries on some of these issues. And I also just want to flag one other area that I think is going to be a very interesting source of experience and ideas in this area, and that is what governments are doing, both the federal government and the state government. Many of you know Beth Novick, who has a wonderful new book called Wiki Government, and she's also now the deputy CTO of the federal government, who's pushing a lot of open government and collaborative government, collaborative processes. And a lot of this is the experience of cloud computing that I think the White House and the Obama administration very committed to, and I think we're going to see a lot of experimentation. I think we're going to see some things that work well and some things that don't. But as in other processes, as in corporate processes and in other processes, we have a governmental system that is from another age. You think about the administrative process and notice and comment and publication in the Federal Register and individual submission of comments, where you could have a very collaborative notice and comment process with a lot of dialogue and a kind of iterative dialogue along the way. So I think we're going to get a lot of very interesting experience from that, as well as from the government just dealing with some of these issues, the kind of four big issues that I laid out at the beginning. Obviously, recognizing that there are some differences with the government as actor and government governance, ranging from First Amendment to other kinds of constraints and issues that come up. But I still think that's going to be a very sort of interesting and valuable resource on these issues.
Thank you very much. So that was kind of a view from legal scholars, from lawyers. And we have the great fortune today, obviously, that we have technologists in the room too, right? And I think my first question actually goes not in that sense to the panelists, but back to the technologists. You've heard now what lawyers are concerned about and, you know, what corporate people are concerned about based on your survey, Cliff. And the question back to the technologists basically is, are these concerns legitimate? Are these concerns that you share from a technological perspective, being involved, say, in, you know, building, designing cloud data centers? Or are these problems that can be solved and should be solved at the level of technology? Really, I was hoping that you could probably comment on that from more from the technological perspective. Where do you share some of the concerns that we lawyers bring to the conversation?
Well, certainly the list of obstacles that was mentioned by security, reliability, privacy, and data ownership, I think it's not only in conversations with lawyers that you will get those four issues. I think it's also in conversations with technologists. You probably get exactly those four issues that I mentioned as primary. So now, whether those questions are solvable from a purely technological standpoint, I think to a greater degree than they are now, yes, but to an absolute degree, no. I mean, it's like the phone network. The network is extremely reliable. It's not perfectly reliable, and we have some means, you know, for dealing with it. But when it doesn't fail, then when it fails, that sort of go out of the technology boundary. The same thing with the privacy and security. Again, to use the phone network, well, most of the time it's private and secure. And we have means, non-technological means, for dealing with situations where that something is violated. And I think we're going to see similar things. I mean, the reliability is going to, technologically, I think, dramatically improve. There's no doubt about that. Both in terms of sort of redundancy of hardware, better methods of developing software. I mean, those are not here, but they will come and they will dramatically improve. But we will never get to an absolute. And I think once you get sort of beyond the level that technologically can be provided, then there's room for, you know, conflict resolution and things like that.
From a technological point of view, it seems to me that one of the things that I don't see actually being discussed here is how the technological changes reframe what the meaning of these concerns is. So, for example, the law itself is an example of what our sense of security is, changed from an early period where security was enforced by armies and serfs who had, or was it, you know, the castle walls, and now we have a huge amount of security that's enforced by law. And so I think that the concern will change in the cloud. What security means will be a very, very different thing. Also, in terms of actually how you store data, when you can move the integrity of the data into the data itself instead of how you put it behind castle walls, then you have a very different idea of what it means for something to be secure. And I think that's also true for privacy. I mean, Twitter is a really interesting example of how privacy is changing and what it means to people. how private they want to be. So to me, I think there's something that hasn't been talked about is how actually the paradigm of what privacy and security means. Reliability, I'm not so sure about, but those two. I think that is changing depending on what the technologies are.
Actually, I'd say exactly the same thing and emphasize it a little bit, because the definition of these terms, just because they're terms, doesn't mean they're well defined. Exactly. It's very clear that the legal, it's been clear for a long time to me that the legal definitions of these terms are far from the practical, technological definitions of these terms, even in simple areas like security. Security has been defined, you know, by cultural norms that, you know, sort of as a kind of safety. It's a relatively broad term. Privacy is a term that I think some justice said was the right to be let alone, not anything about data about persons. It's a much broader term in the law than has been actually implemented in technology, and we're starting to move into areas where technologically we can solve it. An interesting example about reliability is a fundamental way to achieve reliability is by some kind of redundancy. You can do that by coding or distribution across a network. So you don't require a provider to give you a guarantee of reliability. Instead, what you want a provider is to give you a guarantee of essentially non-correlation of fault. Right? And to get a guarantee of non-correlation of fault, that is that one event won't take down the two supposedly separate services, you have to have a view into the infrastructure that provider has that they're often not willing to provide you. So transparency, you know, is ultimately a tool, a technological tool for assuring yourself a lot of things, because you can see into the operations of the guy that is doing that. But there's no pressure for transparency, and in fact, transparency is generally viewed in the U.S. as, you know, impinging on the, you know, on the privilege of the provider to keep his trade secrets, right? And so you ask, the classic example even in the internet is you ask somebody who provides you network services, AT&T, for example, say, I want an independently failing line between point A and point B, and you discover later that because they didn't record that contract, that it actually ran through the same, you know, coax or even on the same fiber as your other provider. And the backhoe takes it out and you're dead. And they say, well, you know, we didn't really promise reliability. So we didn't even promise we weren't going to change it, right? So these kind of issues start to transcend the technological solutions. So the technological solution, which the end user was taking upon themselves, got foiled by a lack of collaboration. Same thing, you can code data. You can put your data in lots of different places or code it so that nobody can put it back together except with three different parts and, you know, it's encrypted. But, you know, you find out that it actually got re-unencrypted by the provider or something. So whose job it is, and unless you can have language that talks about that, trying to lump it into I provide reliability is meaningless. You know, that's the problem. It's basically saying you can't assign these grand terms to one vendor or one contract or one other thing. You have to have a better picture of what you really need to achieve.
Can I just follow on that with the question? But so let's say you're a business looking at it, and you know reliability is a pretty important concept, a principle, characteristic that you're looking for. So what do you do as a business then, if you're looking at, you know, is cloud computing a realistic option or a sort of viable option?
Well, once you're willing to engage, you start problem solving. I have this conversation with DISA, the Navy Marine Corps Internet people, who are considering whether to stop using DISA, which provides supposedly highly reliable connectivity services. And it really matters to Navy Marine Corps Internet people that, you know, operational systems really are reliable, even more than companies, right? And what they said was, well, you know, we could move 80% of our traffic to the public internet and just encrypt it on the public internet, and we don't care about reliability, and what we'll do is we'll integrate the so supposedly reliable business stuff as kind of a fallback, and we'll prioritize stuff to go on that if it has to, and yet we get a much cheaper and much more flexible solution. So we're starting to see end users engage creatively with the resources rather than just outsourcing the entire problem in a lump that says do that. And that creates contract, I mean, I'm sure for lawyers it creates contract nightmares, right? It's kind of the, you know, how do you specify what you want from the internet? But you still want something, it's just, you know, it's a different.
But those nightmares are in part based on the things we have in our heads about what it is, like what is reliable, right? Reliability. That's right. Why it's a contracting nightmare, because we're trying to merge that concept into something that's new and emerging.
Right. I mean, for example, reliability probabilistically is very different from reliability in game theory terms, where you're talking about an adversary versus a random process. And we have SLAs that talk about events as if they're random processes, right? But they don't talk about events as if they're being carried out by your supplier against you or whatever.
So if we may play back to our panelists, Herbert probably first, then maybe Anne-Marie, Cliff, and we can have another round of statements. So we hear from the technologists that they share some of the concerns that we identified in the opening statements. We also hear from the technologists that in part technology may be the answer to the problem, so that there will be areas, as David explained it, where actually we'll find a solution. And Willie also said there are areas where we can actually, you know, address privacy issues. Technology can't provide the perfect solution or the solution as such. We've also heard, though, and I think this is a very interesting point, that the technology, however, may also change our very understanding of what we mean by privacy, security, and so forth. And this seems to me to be a challenge to say that when you have lawyers in the room. My hope, of course, is that you would share, Herbert, Anne-Marie, with your thoughts when you hear this challenge, that first of all, you're thinking about privacy may be inadequate, and second, that, you know, even the term or the concept as such is not very well defined, as we heard from David. How do you feel about it?
Well, first of all, as a lawyer, you're used to people talking about the law as they talk about the weather, right? So, let's get serious, really, in the serious part. You have to understand that the law is a fairly adaptive system. If you look at the American Constitution, it seems to be working since a couple of hundred years yet. So the point where the changing concepts and the changing views of the world, partly initiated by technology, but also by other changes, come into the legal system is through the courts and through the perception of the judges, but with which they interpret the text of the law. And then there might come the point where the legislator says, no, what the judges read into this law is not supportable. So we have to go into a new cycle and have a new law. And then the whole process starts again. So the legal system is fairly adaptive to technological change and also to changes of value. It's a timing question. It's a timing question. How long does the legislator wait till the courts really sort of generate a problem that needs the intervention of the legislator? The legislator may also have its own interest to intervene, even if there is no reason to intervene. Maybe an election coming or something like that.
How to get to an infrastructure, a legal infrastructure that allows for this sort of experimentation and design of new governance mechanisms. And the last point, even once the transition is done and we have this new brave world of alternative institutions and new governance mechanisms, I think the law still, in the traditional sense, plays a role by establishing fallbacks when certain cloud law systems fail. The law certainly also needs to take care, and that was the last sentence by Tom, to set some, establish some basic rules that set the framework for what is possible in terms of private ordering. Also, we shouldn't forget, as Gerard pointed out, that the law has a social function that's in a way the social link that ties things together. And this is another design principle along the lines that Anne-Marie described earlier on that we need to keep in mind when designing new alternative governance regimes for cloud computing. Thank you very much. We have now a break according to the program till 11:50. Thank you.